Blog Talk Radio.
Well, here we go, ladies and gentlemen. It's that time again. It's Saturday, and we rip it open each and every Saturday with this great show, the Doc Talk Podcast, hosted by a brother, a mentor, and a friend to me, Dr. Greg Roscoe in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Yours truly, producing it about 2,500 miles west of him in Los Angeles, where it's about 106 this weekend. 347-205-9631 will get you to the front of the line. I see it's loading up now. Anything after that, catch the archive version because 60 minutes goes by quick. blogtalkradio.com/Mancini Sports, podcast platforms, wherever you subscribe to podcasts, powered now by Mancini Media. So without further ado, more of him, less of me. Let me lay the red carpet, put the podium in its place, hand off the mic, and as we continue on this series, Doc, how are you? How can people get a hold of you? And boy, another great guest coming through here. I'll sit back, man the board, see you in about 28 minutes.
All right. Hey, Mark, thank you very much for that great introduction. Hopefully the studio is well air-conditioned there in L.A. We're doing well. The weather is beautiful here in Pittsburgh. Excuse me. People can't get a hold of me at gjrmd308@outlook.com. You know, we've been doing a series now, starting with rectal colon cancer. Today we're getting into prostate cancer. If there is a little bit of time, we'll talk about renal cancer. Our show will continue with breast cancer coming up, as well as lung cancer, and then cancers of the head and neck. So we've got some very, very excellent guests coming up to talk about these things. And today, I've got a superstar urologist. His name is Dr. John Banerjee. He's internationally trained, has done a tremendous amount of work. He's done writing. And I know, John, currently you're working on a chapter, or maybe the chapter in the book has been done on urology. So he does a lot of robotic. Go ahead.
Thank you so much, Mr. Mancini and Dr. Roscoe, for having me. And it indeed is exciting to be able to share something with people and help them. Yeah, thank you so much for that lovely introduction.
No problem at all. And, you know, as far as working with him, I've known him personally. Very nice gentleman, but a very excellent clinician. And he does quite a bit of robotics also, which is robotic surgery in his practice. And he does do radical prostate surgery, again, with the Da Vinci system. And, you know, we've had a lot of emails, a lot of interest in this coming up segment with regard to prostate cancer. And I'm seeing very similar interest in breast cancer as well with the emails and the calls that I get. Having said that, you know, we talk about prostate cancer, which is one of the most, if not the most common cancer in males worldwide. The numbers are staggering. There's approximately 1,600,000 cases per year diagnosed worldwide. There are about 350,000 deaths a year in males secondary to prostate cancer. You know, if we look at the statistics for the United States, overall almost 300,000 cases a year of prostate cancer are diagnosed. And we're in the 30,000 to 40,000 deaths a year annually. So it's a disease that hits males tremendously. And Dr. John, what has been your experience with this? What have you seen with regard to prostate cancer and the people that do get it? Can you help us with that?
That's correct, Dr. Roscoe. The status.
And can you hear me, John? Oh, I think we've lost him.
An African. Hello,
I'm having
can
a
you
hard
hear me?
Time. And now I can hear you, John.
Can you, Okay. Yeah. So just was just saying that the statistics thing, like you mentioned, we get a lot of patients who are both Caucasian and African Americans. Like you said, prostate cancer is the second most common cancer in men, and as men increase in age and age increases, all men will be at a risk of prostate cancer. In fact, in American men, about 13% of American men will get prostate cancer during their lifetime, and about 2% of American men will die from prostate cancer. So it is something really important. We get to see a lot, and thankfully, we have a whole armamentarium to treat these patients.
John, what has your been experience? You know, I know you have worked in India, you have been in New Zealand, and in the States. Have you seen prostate cancer in all those parts of the world also?
I have, in fact. So in India, screening was not very common. PSA-based screening was not very common until about 10 years ago. So we were diagnosing when I trained in 2007 period of time. We were not diagnosing prostate cancer early. We were seeing patients who came with complications, and it's too treat them. You can control the disease, but you can't get rid. But that has been slowly changing in India, and so PSA screening is picking up. In New Zealand and Australia, that part of the world, they are very abreast with PSA screening, and so it was very similar to what we saw here. Men in their 50s would come for PSA screening. Patients who had a history of prostate cancer in their families would come for PSA screening, very similar to the United States.
Wow. So that in the more developed countries, John, it seems there's more screenings that are being done in the medical community. Can you hear me, John?
Sir, down.
John, I think we're losing you, sir.
Can you hear me now?
Hello? I can hear you now. Yes.
Oh, okay.
We're good.
Okay.
And so
okay.
That, you know, as far as in the more developed countries in the world, it seems
yes.
as the screenings, yes, are being done more frequently.
That's correct. So PSA screening has been around for the past 25, 30 years. And more developed countries have a robust PSA screening program, and that has definitely helped in decreasing the incidence of deaths from prostate cancer. Now, in about 2012, the USPSTF, the United States Preventive Services Task Force, they come out with recommendations for each cancer and each disease. And they came out with a recommendation saying that do not test for PSA and prostate cancer because it causes more harm. And a lot of that was based on older studies which looked at side effects of treating prostate cancer, and they came out with a recommendation saying that it does harm. What happened subsequently was a lot of primary care physicians stopped doing PSA. And while I was in training in Seattle, I did a study which looked at what happened to patients who did not have that, and we looked at 3 years before that recommendation came out and 3 years later, and we found out that patients after the recommendation were being diagnosed at a more later stage of prostate cancer. So since then, I wrote the paper, and then it went back to USPSTF, and the recommendation has changed back to screening again.
Beautiful. John, you know, can you hear me, sir?
Yes, I can. Can you hear me?
Good. I can hear you also. That's excellent.
Perfect.
John, you know, I'd like to go back just a little bit. You know, with regard to the prostate gland, two
yes.
things, John. Where is it and what does it do? You know, if we talk about the basics, the anatomy, where is
Correct.
This prostate gland? You know, we know women do not have one. The males have
right.
it. And then the other
right.
is, what does this gland do?
Okay. So the prostate gland is situated below the urinary bladder, just below the urinary bladder, and it's just behind the pubic bone, so it's actually deep in the pelvis. And from the bladder to what we call the urethra, the male urethra, which runs in the penis, the prostate gland surrounds the urethra. And location-wise, it's in very, very strategic positions. It's just in front of the rectum where you poop from, and that's one of the reasons we can biopsy the prostate through the rectum, and we'll talk about this later. But, yeah,
sure.
it's deep in the pelvis, below the urinary bladder, surrounding the urethra, which runs from the bladder and then into the penis and out. That's where you pee from. Now, the function, yeah, on the prostate.
No, I was just saying with regard to that, John, what's the size of this gland? How big of an organ is the prostate?
So it's about walnut size, about half an ounce, 18 to 20 grams. But it grows as men get older. The prostate gland keeps growing in size. But a normal prostate gland will be about half an ounce, about 18 grams or so, the size of a walnut.
On that size issue, how big can the prostate gland get?
So, as I think most men, it grows to about 2-3 times the normal size, so maybe an ounce and a half or maybe 60 grams, about 2 ounces. But I have patients recently, I've had patients where it's almost 3-3.5 ounces. And they are reports of patients having a really huge prostate gland, about 10 ounces. So that's the upper limit of reports.
Surely.
But most of the time, it's about 2 ounces.
And
going
know, John,
back to the question, yes. Yeah, go ahead.
Just talking again, if you can hear me, with regard to the anatomy, I think you're correct in, you know, saying that the prostate gland actually surrounds the urethra. So this gland actually encompasses the tube that men urinate through, correct?
Correct. Absolutely correct. And there are different portions of the prostate gland. So the part which is surrounds the urethra, the tube which men urinate through, that portion can get obstructed by benign enlargement, non-cancerous enlargement. And that's actually the most common kind we see, non-cancerous enlargement of the prostate, which then causes men problems to urinate.
Got it. And what's the other parts, John?
Yeah. Then we have what's called the peripheral part, the part which is closer to them on the outside. So if you think of the prostate gland like, say, an orange, so you have the central part of the orange, and then you have the outer part of the orange, and then you have the skin of the orange. So prostate cancer typically starts in the outer portion of the orange, nearer the skin, not so much to the center.
Wow.
And going back to your question about what is the function of the prostate gland, so the prostate gland makes different secretions and lets out different enzymes. One of it is called PSA, which stands for prostate-specific antigen. And what we do, it is the semen gets more liquefied and increases motility of sperms. So if the prostate gland was not there, the semen would be much thicker and sperms would not be able to move around very well. So the prostate gland has enzyme which makes the semen thinner and more liquefied. So that's the function of the prostate gland.
And now, John, just for our listeners, the prostate gland does not make the semen. the semen comes from another organ called the seminal vesicles, correct?
Correct. That's correct. So majority of the semen, around 85% of the semen, is contributed by, like you rightly said, the seminal vesicles. Now, that's important, again, because the seminal vesicles anatomically are located right behind the prostate. So they behind the prostate.
Got it. And, you know, John, with regard to function, this function, no doubt, of the prostate gland changes as a male gets older, correct?
By a prostate cancer has been removed, the seminal vesicles.
All right, John, we're having a hard time hearing you. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Good. You're fading in and out on us, but we're hearing what you're saying, so thank you.
Okay.
You know, John, you know, with regard to, you know, we talk about, with regard to medicine, you know, we've kind of broken it down into four steps in dealing with our patients. That we call them the pillars. John, the first pillar is, you know, the history. What's the patient in the office for? The second pillar is our physical examination. Our third pillar are diagnostic testings. And then the fourth pillar is decision making. So that, John, when someone comes in to see you, what do they talk about? Why are they there? You know, what are the reasons someone would come in to a urologist for this? Can you help us with that, John?
Yes, absolutely. Can you hear me? Am I still audible?
Yes. I think we've, okay. Mr. Mancini, are you hearing him well in L.A.? I don't know where
Hello?
Mr. Mancini is, but John, go ahead.
Okay, perfect. So most of the time, patients are referred by their primary care for an elevated PSA. So the primary care doctor would have checked a PSA blood test as a routine health evaluation, and the PSA is elevated, and we'll talk about what does elevation mean. And most of the time, patients come with that. Patients can also have symptoms of prostate cancer, like frequency, which means going to the bathroom very often, or urgency, which means not able to postpone the urination. But those are less common symptoms and are more common in advanced disease. So if patients come with that, generally the disease is more advanced. So a majority of patients would come with just an elevated blood test. Now, rarely, when patients have not had access to primary care due to whatever reason, and they get prostate cancer and don't know about it, they can come with more advanced symptoms like blood in their urine, difficulty to pee, or sometimes kidney failure because of blockage of the tubes due to the prostate cancer. But thankfully, those are rare.
All right. And, you know, John, with regard to things like urgency, frequency, you know, where a male gets up at night, is that because the prostate gland is growing into the bladder, or is it squeezing that tube that they pee through? Well, why do these symptoms occur?
Right. So there are two kinds of symptoms what we talk about. One is called voiding symptoms, which basically means patients have difficulty in letting urine out. And that's because the prostate gland is squeezing on the tube and obstructing the flow. The other symptoms we call are storage or irritative symptoms, which are the frequency, the urgency, the waking up at night. And that is thought to be secondary to changes which occur in the bladder. So what the bladder is trying to do now, it sees that there's an obstruction. The bladder is trying to squeeze harder to overcome the obstruction. And the bladder muscle undergoes changes. And because of the changes in the bladder, the frequency, urgency, and waking up at night are secondary to those.
Got it. So if a male is noticing these problems, maybe it's a good idea to get checked up by his family doctor, correct? We want to be suspicious,
but
not just put these symptoms under the rug.
Absolutely.
You know,
and
because you
and I both are males, we know we tend to put away our health and don't take care of our health like we should. And I think we owe it to our patients, and we owe it to our family to be able to go to our primary care for regular checkup. Absolutely.
I think you're right. You know, as far as the premise of our show, John, that we've been on, again, we want to give our listeners good information and, you know, some red flags. You know, things aren't going well. Hey, we've got to go in and, you know, have our nurse practitioner or our PA or a physician start to look at us and go ahead and start to be more diagnostic. You know,
absolutely.
As far as
absolutely.
PSA, I know that's the very important testing for this. The other thing that is in the literature that we want to prepare our male patients for is the digital rectal exam. You want to talk about that also, John?
Absolutely. So we'll talk about digital rectal exam first. The short form is DRE. So digital basically means using a digit, which is the finger, and rectal is in the rectum and obviously exam. So like I said, the anatomy, the prostate is in front of the rectum. So by putting a finger into the rectum where you poop from, we can feel the prostate gland. And it's important for a couple of reasons. One is a good rectal exam by a urologist who does this all the time will be able to tell us the size of the prostate gland quite accurately. And the second is the consistency of the prostate gland. So the prostate gland should be fairly soft. And an early sign of prostate cancer would be if there's some asymmetry, which basically means one portion of the prostate gland might be soft like it's supposed to be, but the other side feels slightly firm. And that's a very early sign of prostate cancer and can be picked up. So a digital rectal exam is an important component of examination, yes.
So that, Joe, when a male would come in and say, hey, you know, I've got some problems with urinating. My PSA, which was done by my family doctor, he tells me, according to the scale, it's elevated. And he told me that you were going to examine me. And, you know, as far as, John, I don't want to get into a lot of detail, but indeed, when one does the exam, the patient is lying on his side, correct, on the exam table. And then you approach the patient from the back with gloves on, and then go ahead and you enter up into the rectal area, correct?
Correct. So the most important thing to make patients feel comfortable is to explain it to them, explain what we are doing. Like you rightly said, patients are either lying down on their side. Some people like patients bending over with their elbows flat on the table, and that's another way to examine them. But like you rightly said, gloves are put on. And then we use a generous amount of lubrication, and we first lubricate around the rectum and make sure everything is relaxed, and then slowly examined with a finger. It's people feel it's uncomfortable, but I think most men tolerate it fairly well, as long as they know what they've come in for and the doctor explains everything.
Wonderful. No, very well. John, there's no numbing medication used. It's more of a lubrication that's used for that test, correct?
That's correct. So there's no numbing medication. The test typically is around 15 to 20 seconds. You get most of the information. Now, sometimes that might be the longest 15 to 20 seconds a band might play. it's not very uncomfortable. Having said that, I have not had one, so I wouldn't really know what it feels like.
Sure.
But my time will come.
Go ahead.
No, I just said my time will come when I will need one of those.
Surely. John, with regard to, say, we've listened to the patient, we've done our pillar one, we've listened, we understand, we go to pillar two, where we're examining the patient, the rectal area, probably lymph nodes in the groin area as well. John, what about repeating? They talk about repeating the PSA if it is elevated, to wait several weeks and repeat it before we start to get real aggressive. Do you find that to be true?
Absolutely. So I would never go on a single PSA. So the first step would be to repeat a PSA. Now, when we repeat, we want to be very, very careful about when to repeat it, because after an exam, the PSA might rise suddenly because of the examination. So we want to wait for at least 2 weeks after an exam to repeat the PSA.
Got it. And, John,
due to the exam.
Yes. Other factors from what the literature tells us is also sexual activity. Not to have sexual activity around the testing time. What is that all about?
Right. So whenever there is sexual activity, the semen comes out, and then the prostate gland, like we talked about, has to release its enzymes to liquefy the semen, because that's what its function is. And having done that, the prostate gland its enzyme then is one of the falsely elevate the PSA. There are other things that could falsely elevate the PSA. For example, infection, or somebody had stones and the PSA was done too soon. Sometimes some patients have what we call urinary retention, where because of benign non-cancerous prostate enlargement, which blocks the outlet like we talked about, patients are not able to pee and then go to the ER and get a catheter to release the urine. And if a PSA is done at that time, that again will be falsely elevated.
All right. And, along those same lines, John, before we get into doing diagnostic testing and therapy, with regard to a prostate infection, something called prostatitis, does that elevate our PSA also?
Yes, sir. So any infection, especially of the prostate, prostatitis sometimes might elevate the PSA to up to 10 to 15 times the normal.
Wow. So it is important that one have this checked, but also the doctor that's doing this realizes the other possible implications or the other reasons for this, so he's not going to scare the patient, correct?
Correct, absolutely. And I think it's very important for primary care doctors also to know that most of the time a PSA, elevation of PSA, the chance that it will be cancer is only about 25%, 1 in 4. So 3 out of 4 times the elevated PSA might be due to other causes like we talked about, or just a benign non-cancerous enlargement of the prostate.
Excellent. Mr. Mancini, let's go to the studio in L.A. Do you have questions?
Yeah, what a great interview, and we'll keep that track going. Gary from Duluth, Minnesota, with an interest in one, said he's heard of the term milking the prostate to clean out the system. What is that all about? That's a great question. I've heard of that too myself, but I don't know what that is.
So Dr. Yeah. John, what's that all about, milking the prostate?
Yeah. Hi, Gary. So it was thought that the prostate might be engorged, and that could be the reason for some symptoms like we talked about. And prostatitis, in some places, they thought it might be due to an engorged prostate, and that was done where you do the exact same thing, the rectal exam, and then you move your finger up and down multiple times to kind of drain the prostate. But that's not very commonly done, especially if somebody has an active infection, because what you're doing is you're milking that, but you're getting all the bacteria into the bloodstream and can cause sepsis or bad blood infection. So a lot of people don't do milking of the prostate anymore.
And, John, who would do that? Who is the provider that would actually perform that procedure? Would it be a urologist?
Correct. The urologist would do it. And that's more uncomfortable, and it's actually some patients describe it as painful. One, because it takes a longer time. Two, because you're squeezing on the prostate with fairly firm pressure, and that can be quite uncomfortable.
Beautiful. And that is, John, that would be an office procedure, though, correct?
Correct. It would be an office procedure, correct.
Very good. All right, Mr. Mancini, go ahead.
Daniel from Pontiac, Michigan says, guys, great show as usual. Keep up the great work, Doc. I love this series on what you guys are all talking about, cancer and stuff like that. He more or less says, with the procedure with the prostate, how do you know when to get your prostate checked? They say a lot between 50 and 70 years old. And how about for some people that don't know if they have an infected prostate or anything? What would be the symptoms? That's a great question
sure,
as
John,
well.
Yeah, you know, I think, John, this goes into our pillar one, pillar two, and then, you know,
right.
Going into pillar three, diagnostic. Do you want to pick that up and see how do you handle that? You know, what's your experience been with regard to diagnosing these prostatic conditions?
Great question. So I'll just address the first part of the question.
Surely.
When should you go and get evaluated? So men in their 50s, as soon as you hit 50, you should go and get evaluated, have an exam, have a PSA blood test. Having said that, men who have a history of prostate cancer, like a father or an uncle or a brother, they should go in earlier, just like colorectal cancer. We screen them earlier, and we screen them at 45. So men without any family history, 50, men with a family history of 45. Having said that, there are other cancers which might be related to prostate cancer, and we know this because of the BRCA gene, which is common for breast cancer. So patients who have a mother or a maternal aunt who had breast cancer or somebody with ovarian cancer or pancreatic cancer should also get screened earlier, because about 10 to 15% of prostate cancers are hereditary, and they might have the BRCA gene, which I just talked about, similar to breast cancer. And those who have that family history should get evaluated at the age of 45. Now, with regard to... Yes.
I was just, again, not to interrupt, but I was saying these things are very important in our initial history taking. If we're here under pillar one, listening to the patient, but these are the things we'd like to know about, correct? Getting our history very solid.
Absolutely. Like you very rightly said, Dr. Roscoe, the four pillars are super important no matter how advanced we become technologically. You have to depend on those four pillars. And like you said, a good history is half the battle won, because then you know where to focus. It's very much solving a crime case. You know, you've got to have all the facts. So a good history is very, very important.
Well, you know, John, I think we both, you know,
see very difficult, complex patients. And, you know, I tell my staff as well as I tell the patients, you know, my job is to be like a detective. You're giving me data, but I've got to put it together and try to solve the
Correct.
Crime here and figure out
Correct.
What the problem is. Right? You do the same thing.
Absolutely. And every good doctor should do that. Listen
yes.
to the patient.
Excellent. All right, Mr. Mancini, go ahead.
Yeah, let me take one more, and I'll get it back to you guys to continue this great topic. Frank from Independence, Missouri said, is there a clear cut way of what causes prostate cancer? He's listening live to you.
Wonderful. We'll give it to the expert. Go ahead, doctor.
Hi. Good morning. Let's see. Yes.
Good.
So the most common cause, so to speak, of prostate cancer is age. As you grow older, you will invariably be at a risk of prostate cancer. Then we talked about hereditary prostate cancer. So family history of prostate cancer or breast, ovarian, pancreatic cancer puts you at an increased risk. And in the family history, the more the number of people with prostate cancer, for example, a father with prostate cancer increases the risk about 1.5 times. A father and an uncle increases the risk to 2.5 times. So more the number, more the risk. Then diet. So patients who have things like carb diet or patients who are obese have an increased risk of prostate cancer. Again, patients who don't take their vitamins, so low vitamin E and low vitamin D and some micro elements are also linked to increased risk of prostate cancer. I tell patients, dietary advice, I tell patients, it's similar to heart disease. Whatever is good for your heart, like fresh leafy vegetables, nuts, less red meat, all of that is good for your prostate. So a heart healthy diet is healthy for your prostate also.
Excellent, John. You know, John, what about, you know, we've talked about factors in other cancers. What about smoking as well as alcohol, John? Is there a correlation in the literature that talks about one that drinks alcohol not in moderation as well as a smoker or a chewer?
So smoking and alcohol does have an increased risk, but it's moderate. When we talk about risk, we talk about relative risk, which basically means with relation to somebody who does not do it. And a relative risk of 1 basically means there's no increased risk one time. But with
yep.
smoking and alcohol, the relative risk is about 1.3, 1.4. So it is to be, but it's not very strong association. I think the more important associations are, of course, age, obesity, bad eating habits, and not having a good diet. I think those are more important.
What about, John, anything with venereal disease? Is there a correlation, with venereal disease affecting the prostate?
There used to be a lot of literature earlier on saying patients who've had, say, STDs like gonorrhea or syphilis might be at an increased risk. But then the thought was the increased risk actually might be because of a prostate infection, and then some of the prostate cells undergo change, and that could be a cause for prostate cancer. So I would say a single STD, probably not, but obviously somebody who has high-risk behavior and has multiple STDs, yes, definitely that could increase the risk of prostate cancer just by increasing the inflammatory response in the
Surely.
Prostate.
Excellent explanation. John, I just received a couple of emails, and I have one here that says, when do you biopsy the prostate? When do you biopsy the prostate, John?
That's great. Let us to our diagnosis
yes.
of prostate cancer. So, great. So the biopsy of the prostate should be done based on, like we talked about, PSA. So, again, we would not biopsy based on a single PSA. We would wait, repeat the PSA. Now, what PSA do we use? That's an area, a gray area, and very confusing. So I tend to make things simple. So a PSA of 4 is what was classically used, saying anyone with a PSA of 4 or more. But then it's also age-dependent. Like we said, as age increases, the prostate size increases and your chance of prostate cancer increases. So what about a guy who is 45 or 50 with a PSA of 4? That's too high. So we have something called age-specific PSA. So for patients 50 or younger, we use a cutoff of 3. For patients 60 and older, we use a cutoff of 4. And then we just don't, like I said, we don't look at one PSA. We also use some modifications of PSA. We use something called PSA velocity, which basically means if I check your PSA this year and I check it the next year, how soon is it increasing? So we know it will increase every year. The allowable
yes.
increase, the allowable increase per year is 0.75. That means 3/4. So let me give you an
yep.
example. If a patient had a PSA of 3 this year and repeats a PSA test next year around the same time, and it's under 3.75, that's okay. Patient has a PSA which is more than 0.75 of the previous year, that's a cause for concern. So that's another indication to biopsy the prostate. The third thing we use is something called PSA density, which basically means how much is a PSA with relation to the size of the gland. So if the size of the prostate is small, but the PSA is proportionately larger, that's again a cause for concern, because we know a small prostate should make small amount of PSA.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? So if the PSA is proportionately too high, then again we would biopsy. And the fourth time we would biopsy is when we do the exam, an abnormal exam finding. We talked about the prostate needing to be uniform and soft all over. So if one area is asymmetrical or one area is abnormal, that would be the fourth indication to biopsy the prostate.
And, John, you know, as far as multiple indications, any one of these indications significant enough to get a biopsy done? And any one
yes.
of those should trigger, you know, my next step with you, patient, is we need to do a biopsy.
Correct.
Wow.
Correct.
And
all of those which I mentioned individually are reasons for biopsy. So you don't need to have all. You need to have just any one of them, either increased PSA velocity or an increased density or an abnormal finding or a PSA, repeated PSA, more than what is expected for your age. All
wow.
are indications
and
for biopsy on their
excellent.
Own.
Excellent. You know, John, with regard to letting our listening audience know, this is something that we need to be a little bit vigilant about seeing our practitioner, correct? We need to have kind of an ongoing rapport with them so that these things can be checked to see if we're going down a path that could be very serious or maybe not so serious, but it's something we need to be cognizant of about. And, you know, keep an eye on our health as well as listening to the practitioner on this or going to a specialist. John, do you take people have not been to a family doctor, but they're worried, they have some indications here that they may have a prostate problem? Will you see them without a family doctor referral?
Absolutely. I would see anyone who, one, has not had an exam for a couple of years, or has a prostate problem. So if a patient, say, comes to you, Dr. Roscoe, for an ENT problem, and he says, hey, doc, I also have a problem peeing, and I'm having maybe some blood in the urine, you don't
sure.
need to send the patient back to the primary care. You could just pick up the phone and give me a call, and the urologist should
yes.
be able to see the patient directly. Yes.
Beautiful. No, I mean, I agree with that. You know, with regard to when people come in, say, to see me, and they come in with chest pain, I don't send them back to the family doctor. We call the cardiologist.
Correct.
All right, correct,
absolutely.
Or et cetera, et cetera.
Absolutely.
Or if a woman would
yes.
come in, you know, with some asthma, but say, you know, I have a lump in my breast. We absolutely right.
right.
We refer directly to the doctor to take care of them. So, a very good point.
Right.
And, John, you know, we talked about pillar one. We talked about pillar two. You know, we're talking about pillar three. John, and our time is running out this morning. But I want to talk about two things. Imaging.
Yes.
What imaging
yes.
do you do for a prostate? And tell me how you biopsy the prostate. Where is it done? Is the patient put asleep? Can you talk about these two issues in our, or we're losing, where time is going by the wayside? But go ahead, John.
Yeah, we'll talk about that real quick. So the prostate biopsy is done in the office setting, sometimes in the radiology suite. Most of the patients can tolerate it. We give them a local anesthetic. It is done, like you said, in the left lateral position, which means patient is lying on the side. We give a numbing at this point in time. So we would insert an ultrasound probe, which is typically as thick as your thumb. The ultrasound probe is lubricated well, is inserted into the rectum, and the prostate is right in front of that, and I can see that. And then through the ultrasound probe, we have a little hole where a needle goes in for the biopsy. Through that hole, I first give what's called a local anesthetic, a prostate block, which is just bupivacaine, lidocaine, and that gives good anesthesia, and then we biopsy the prostate in that way. Two other things with regards to diagnosis. One is MRI.
Well, John, can I
yes.
stop you for a second? John,
absolutely.
Typically, you know, thank you very much. I didn't mean to interrupt, but I wanted to let our listeners know, how many biopsies typically do you do? Where do you do them? What's the identification of these prostates, of biopsies?
Great question. So we do typically 12 biopsies, so 12 passes of the needle. So when we put the ultrasound probe, the prostate, we can see there are two zones, the right side and the left side. So we take 6 from each, and we stagger it. So if you think again of the prostate, now this time we'll change the fruit from the orange to an apple. So if we think about an apple, you have a broad portion of the apple, and then you have the narrow portion. So the broad portion is closer to the bladder, and the narrow
yes.
portion is closer to the urethra, called the tube, which where you urinate. And then you have a middle portion. So from each of these, we take 2 biopsies. So 2 from the broader portion, 2 from the center, 2 from the narrow portion, and that will be 6 on each side, and we take both sides. So that's 6 × 2, 12 biopsies.
And John, with regard to, do you go through the urethra? You know, is there going to be blood in the patient's urine after this?
Yes. So common symptoms after this will be, because the needle is going through the rectum, but like we talked about, the prostate is engulfing the urethra, surrounding the urethra. So patients will have blood in their urine and blood in their stool for about a couple of days. Most of the time, it will be self-limiting. We ask patients to make sure they are well hydrated, drink lots of water, and that should settle it. I tell patients, you need to come back to the ER if you have one of two things. One is a fever, because that means there's an infection. So we cover the procedure with antibiotics. We give antibiotics the day before, the day off, and the day after. And so if patients
Excellent.
Have a fever, that means there's an infection, they need to come back in. And I tell patients, If your urine looks thick like tomato ketchup, then that's too much blood in your urine, and then you need to come back in.
Excellent. And, you know, John, this whole procedure, you do do you put people asleep for this also, or sedate them if they're a little queasy about having this done like that?
Yes, that is an option. So most of the patients have it done in the office, around 80%, I would say. Around 20% of patients want to be put to sleep, a light sedation like a Twilight. The procedure per se takes only about 10 to 12 minutes. And so we can definitely do that. We can some kind of light anesthesia, and we can do the procedure.
Excellent. And then, John, you know, we're getting out of time here. Well, imaging, how do you image the prostate? Is there cases where you may want to do an imaging study as an MR or something along those lines? Is that necessary?
Yes, yes, absolutely. So an MRI is a great tool because it looks at the prostate very well, and we use something called a diffusion-weighted, or it's called a multi-parametric. So we look at three different perspectives in the MRI to give us more information. And the MRI gives us very, very good information about what we call clinically significant prostate cancer. So the MRI is good at picking up prostate cancer which requires treatment. So again, we need to be picking up prostate cancer which requires treatment, because a good amount of prostate cancer is what we call low-risk prostate cancer, which would not cause problems during the patient's lifetime, and they do not require treatment. The MRI is good at weeding out clinically significant prostate cancer which requires treatment. So that's a great tool to diagnose and manage prostate cancer.
And, John, would you, through a course of visitation and things like that, would you repeat an MRI in 2 or 3 years if there was a little suspicion, or what would your frequency be, or wouldn't you be doing that on an ongoing basis?
No, so the MRI typically, unfortunately, the way medicine works in the United States, not all the time is MRI covered by insurance. And in fact, an MRI is not covered as a primary modality. So we would never do an MRI in the United States. In Europe and in India and in New Zealand and Australia and the rest of the world, MRI can be done as an initial diagnostic modality, but not in the United States because insurance doesn't cover it, unfortunately. So most of the time we use MRI as a follow-up. So somebody who's been diagnosed with prostate cancer, and we're following them up, and we're not doing anything to treat the prostate cancer because, like we said, it might be low risk, not requiring treatment. We follow them up with an MRI.
And, John, what percentage of prostate cancers are low risk? Is it a small percentage?
Thankfully, a fairly large percentage is low risk. About 60%, 6 out of 10 times, after prostate biopsy diagnosed with cancer, they are low-risk prostate cancer. So that's encouraging, though men might say, okay, I got diagnosed with prostate cancer, but 6 out of 10 times you probably don't need treatment, because if the prostate cancer will not be the one to kill you, you might die of old age or heart disease or lung disease, but not prostate cancer. So that's
good. Excellent. John, excellent discussion. Mark Mancini, what do you have left for us?
Get one quick one in. We'll do a recap. We're up against it with about 5 minutes left, but Nick from San Jose, California, coming in, basically says hemorrhoids compared to the polyps, when you cut them out, is there a similarity there?
Is he talking about rectal hemorrhoids or rectal pyrite?
Yeah, rectal hemorrhoids, more or less, and when they do the prostate exam, usually they'll cut out the cap polyps on it. So is that similar to hemorrhoids? I guess that's the question. I don't want to butcher it on them either.
Yeah. John, do you want to handle that? Do you understand what the question was?
Not really. Do you... one of the thoughts I thought was, is he wondering, do we cut out the prostate just like a hemorrhoid? Is that the question?
No, I don't know, and I lost him right now, but I'm just trying to think. I guess the similarities between the hemorrhoids and the polyps, or what are the similarities here, if there is any?
I don't think they're right.
Right. I don't think they are similar. When we do the biopsy, if he was talking about the biopsy, no, it's not. We're not cutting out. We're just taking little pieces, snippets with the needle, but we're not really cutting out big chunks of tissue. That's
okay.
Different from if we were removing the prostate for prostate cancer, like it would need to be done when we are treating prostate cancer with the robot. In that, we remove the prostate completely and then join the bladder back to the urethra. We didn't get a chance to talk about that, but yes, that's done when we're treating. Yeah.
Excellent. I think there's a lot of questions here.
Wow.
Mark, do you have any other questions for us?
We're going to be up against it. We got to get him back because we got about 3 minutes,
right.
And I wanted to get a recap real fast, get all where they can get a hold of John and you and
yes.
stuff like that. Otherwise,
beautiful.
We're going to be going over.
All right. We don't want to go over. John,
yeah.
You know what? As far as a summary, could we say that, you know, overall, prostate cancer is a little bit of a silent type cancer that, you know, there's not a lot of symptoms that go on to trigger
absolutely.
This unless things do get out of control. So
correct.
If our listeners are having some urinary difficulties, maybe they need to start a process of being checked by their medical
yes.
providers. Is that a good summary?
That is a very good summary, yes. So don't miss out on your regular appointment. Go and see your primary care doctor, because a lot of times, like you rightly said, most of the time we diagnose prostate cancer just based on an abnormal, and you might not have symptoms
yes.
till they are later in the disease, correct.
John, do you want to tell our listeners how they can get a hold of you or would like to communicate questions to you?
Absolutely. So my name is John Banerjee. My number is 206-582-8834. And email is a good place to get in touch with me. You can find me on the Penn Highlands Healthcare website, and I would be happy to help anyone. We urologists have a great network in the United States, and we have a lot of friends who could help you in whichever city or state you are. I could contact urologists there who could also help you. So I'd be happy to help anyone and take questions. Yeah.
Excellent. Thank you. And my email, ggrmd308@outlook.com. I'd like to go ahead thank Dr. Banerjee for an excellent discussion. I would love to have you back again. There are a lot of other urologic situations we'd like to talk about, including kidney cancers. I'd like to let our listeners know that next week we are having our holistic nursing team on to talk about coping with cancer. If one were to have cancer, how do you get through it? You know, are there some other palliative ways that we can help to keep your body strong, to get you healed after treatments, and the emotion of it all? So that overall should be a great show next week, and I think we're going to go ahead and put that out there. We also have upcoming cancer of the lung in about 2 weeks, and then we have breast cancer following that. So we have some interesting doctors on to talk about the disease entities. John, would like to have you back again. Mark Mancini, do you want to close the show?
Yeah, what a show it is, and boy almighty, you learn so much, and knowing that John out there has connections across different states, that helps the listeners too, in case you want to get a hold of him. Next week, I can't wait. Marianne Costello and all these great people coming through. The series continues on cancer, breast cancer next week, and Boy, that'll be a great one for the listeners as well.
Yes.
For the two in Pittsburgh, yours truly, Mark Mancini in Los Angeles. Stay safe. Tell all your friends about it. And keep the flame burning each and every week on this Doc Talk podcast. Catch it on blogtalkradio.com/Mancini Sports. Thanks for tuning in.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.